Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now set. May God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. Court has three causes on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Deloitte and Touche, LLP, and Ronald Bignon versus the 14th Court of Appeals, an original mandamus proceeding. And Texas Utilities Electric Company versus Jackie Byron Timmons, individually and as representative of the estate of Billy Edwin Byron from Hill County. The court is allotted 25 minutes for each side to present arguments in the first cause and 20 minutes for each side in the second cause. The relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. You may make application with the clerk if you wish to purchase a tape of the argument. The court is ready to hear argument from relator in Deloitte and Touche versus 14th Court.
May it please the court,
counsel.
This case is an attempted class action, an abusive class action, attempting to superimpose the Texas Securities Act over residents of 22 states, countries of Bermuda and Canada. They're trying to expand this case, which is essentially a $200,000 case that's filed by the two individuals who are the class representatives in a class in which they seek $47 million by their own pleadings and damages. They're in essence trying to make the Texas Securities Act the law of the land by this case. There's no question, there's no dispute in the record that no other lawsuits have been filed by these purported class members. There was nothing at the hearing on class certification to indicate that there's a single other person in the entire universe who wants to be part of this litigation. Yet under the Court of Appeals decision, not only these two class representatives, but these other 200 people who are the purported class members, if the Court of Appeals decision is maintained, will be able to maintain their actions against Deloitte and Touche and Ronald Bignon without ever having to show that they even read the prospectus that they're complaining of, without ever having to show that they read the audit opinion that they're complaining of.
Counsel, assuming all that is true, how in God's green earth do we have jurisdiction to hear this case?
You have jurisdiction, Your Honor, because as the court is aware, we filed an application for writ of error from the Court of Appeals decision. It was dismissed for want of jurisdiction. The court has two types of jurisdiction, as it is aware. It has jurisdiction on the law side, the appellate jurisdiction. It has its mandamus jurisdiction. The Constitution of the state and indeed the legislature have ceded to you in Article 22.022, I believe, your mandamus jurisdiction. There's nothing in the jurisdiction.
With regards to class actions, how do we have jurisdiction over interlocutory appeals?
You have jurisdiction, Your Honor, to hear mandamus over any matter that you believe is relevant to the principles of law as determined by this court. The mere fact that the legislature has said that there's very limited right to appeal, conflict jurisdiction or dissent jurisdiction, does not implicate in any way your mandamus jurisdiction. But that's on the law side. This is on the equity side. Yes,
but
Your Honor.
Will we not be doing by mandamus what we could not do by writ of error?
Well, Your Honor, the case books are replete with examples where you have done that very thing. The amicus brief filed by the Texas Association of Defense Counsel chronicles many areas in which mandamus jurisdiction has been maintained, really going back to the late 1800s in situations where you did not have appellate jurisdiction. The principles are separate. We qualify, we believe, under the normal principles of for mandamus, and that the appellate court abused the standard of review in reviewing the denial of class certification, and because we have no adequate remedy of appeal. We're in a much different situation, I'd suggest, than, for example, those who come before you with special appearance mandamus actions. We have been to the Court of Appeals. It has reversed us. That's when we were first aggrieved. We were not aggrieved in the trial court. It's the Court of Appeals action that we're complaining of here. And indeed, we
filed. The Court of Appeals made a very clear declaration that there is no basis in law or in fact for Judge Smith's order.
That's true, Your Honor. It abused its discretion in so doing because it misapplied the standard of review. It was required to apply a discretionary standard of review. If there's any basis on which Judge Smith's order could have been maintained, it should have been upheld. That's what we're complaining about. They misapplied the standard of review. They had no discretion to misapply the law. That's the basis of
our... Is that an error of law, then?
It is an error of law on their part, Your Honor.
On the Court of Appeals?
On the Court of Appeals, yes, sir. But
then what about the statute that says the Court of Appeals is final on both questions of law and fact in an interlocutory appeal in a class action situation?
Well, indeed, the statute says that, Your Honor. But again, this court on many occasions has assumed mandamus jurisdiction where it does not have appellate jurisdiction. It is your right to do so, and you have done so on many prior occasions. That statute does not take away from you your mandamus jurisdiction. It simply limits the appellate jurisdiction which can come to you.
What is the best case that you have that supports your premise that you're arguing right now? Cite it to us, please.
One case, Your Honor, is Pajak versus Bill Mowbray Motors, 647 Southwest 2nd, 253, which said, absent a special statute granting jurisdiction, Article 2225B makes final in the Court of Appeals decisions reviewing interlocutory orders made appealable to the Court of Appeals.
But that was not a class action suit.
No, Your Honor, it's not. But I'd suggest, Justice Gonzalez, there's no difference in a class action suit. It's an interlocutory appeal. It's a situation in which your appellate jurisdiction is limited by statute. But just because it's a class action suit, it should not be treated any different way as far as reviewing it by this court's standards of mandamus.
Do you have any situation where, can you point to a case where the court was limited by the statute from having appellate jurisdiction review over a case? And the court granted a mandamus for purposes other than to protect its own ultimate jurisdiction. For instance, the Courts of Appeals refusing to certify a question meant that this court didn't get to review something that the legislature wanted us to review. The Court of Appeals refusing to rule on a motion for rehearing, but refusing to file a late statement of fact, those types of cases. Prevents the case from being processed through the appellate mechanism so that it could ultimately come to our court. But here the legislature has made a determination that this kind of ruling should not be made by this court. And I can't find a case where we've granted a writ of mandamus in the face of that type of limited statute.
There's none dealing with this statute, but there are cases, Your Honor, in which you have mandamus courts other than in aid of your jurisdiction. One example is a series of cases, again, cited in the Texas Association of Defense Counsel brief, dealing with contempt judgments not involving confinement. Contempt not involving confinement is not reviewable by appeal. But this court has stepped in and has exercised its mandamus jurisdiction.
There are those kind of cases where there is no appeal. There has been no appeal, like the Court of Appeals mandamus ruling, original proceeding, where the court has stepped in. But where the legislature has provided an appellate remedy, but provided that appellate remedy is going to be in some court other than the Supreme Court, and the ruling is over the whole case. It's not like there's a discovery ruling, for instance, in the trial court in a slander case prior to 1993.
Well, it's over the class certification issue. It's not over the merits of the case.
But that's over the whole issue that has been set aside by the legislature for an appeal. Can you point to a single case where they were ruling over the whole issue that has been set aside by the legislature, been designated appropriate for an appeal? The appeal is not to this court, and yet this court has exercised extraordinary relief.
I cannot point to a case dealing with the interlocutory appeal statute, Your Honor, but I would say that the principle is the same. You either have appellate jurisdiction or you do not have appellate jurisdiction. In the absence of some indication by the legislature that it intends to deprive you of the other form of jurisdiction it's giving you, the mandamus jurisdiction, I would say it doesn't matter. It's the same situation.
Are you suggesting that the legislature can limit jurisdiction conferred on this court by the Constitution?
Well, the constitutional provision, Justice Cornyn, dealing with your exercise of mandamus jurisdiction, I think cedes to the legislature, in part, the right to pass legislation granting you that that jurisdiction, which it did in 22.022.
So your answer is yes? Or?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the legislature could pass a statute saying the Supreme Court of Texas, notwithstanding any constitutional grant of jurisdiction, cannot hear certain types of cases.
Perhaps it could, Your Honor, and the importance here is it has not done so with respect to this type of case. It says you cannot hear these as an appellate matter on the law side. It has not sought to restrict your mandamus jurisdiction on this type of case.
That strikes me as a little strange. I thought the basic charter preempted any legislative incursion.
Well, the Constitution, in preparing for this, I learned a lot about it, but the Constitution indeed does have a section which authorizes the legislature to pass legislation authorizing the court to exercise its original mandamus jurisdiction. It then did so in 22.022.
Let's say your argument prevails and we write an opinion in your favor. Why would that not establish precedent that in every class action lawsuit where an argument can be made that the Court of Appeals did not appropriately apply the law, there would be appeal to the Supreme Court by mandamus?
Well, there are a couple of reasons, Your Honor. One, this court has the ultimate and absolute authority to control what you do with those mandamus applications. And we've seen many instances where you don't grant the motions for leave. That's one answer. The other is, we're quite differently situated here in that our complaint is not about the trial court's action, which is normally what you see here. Our case is the only reported case we've been able to find in the state of Texas where the appellate court overruled a denial of class certification. All the other cases go the other direction, where class certification has been granted, the appellate court considers that, in almost all cases affirms that because they're applying the discretionary standard to what the court did, the trial court did, who has pretty much absolute discretion within certain broad parameters to certify or not certify, depending upon the evidence that's presented to it. So our case is different in that respect because this is our first chance to complain about the action of the Court of Appeals. Our appellate right in which we filed our application for writ of error was truly illusory because of the statute. We tried to assert conflict jurisdiction. We did our best. The court dismissed it for want of jurisdiction. So that was the first point at which we were aggrieved, and this is our first opportunity to cure that. You might say, why not send it back to the trial court, let us bring it back up through the same process again? The answer to that is twofold. One, ordinarily the trial court would have the ability to reconsider class certification decisions. In this case, with two very limited exceptions, the Court of Appeals has put handcuffs on him. He's going to be mad if he tries to reconsider that with claims by the plaintiffs of law of the case and res judicata. So he'll be unable to do anything about that. If we wait until after the case is tried on the merits and we try to appeal then, we're coming right back through the appellate court, which itself is presumably, or at least we cannot presume that it will reconsider these issues that it's already passed on. That's why we think our situation is unique. That's why we think this court can and should exercise its mandamus jurisdiction because of the harm, because of the position we've been put in.
Let me see if I understand your argument. do I understand your argument to be that a trial court, a district judge, when faced with a application to certify a class, and the proponent's certification meet every requirement of Rule 42, in the face of, despite the fact that all the requirements have been met, trial court has the power to say, I'm not going to certify.
Your Honor, Benson versus Texas Commerce Bank, Dallas Court of Appeals case, held just that. We say that's not the case here. We say they wholly failed to satisfy the six requirements of the Rule 42. But there is law that says just that. Even though you meet all six of those requirements, the court still has discretion to refuse to certify.
On what basis?
Just the court's discretion, Your Honor. I admit it's at the outer edge of the envelope, and we cite that case only to show that the discretion, as has been determined by the appellate courts of the state, is very broad. But again, we don't believe that's the case here. In fact, in order for there to have been an abuse of discretion by the trial court here, it would be necessary for the appellate court to determine that all six of those prongs were not met, that he abused his discretion on every single one of those prongs that are required by Rule 42A and B4. The standard of review for abuse of discretion, it's stated in lots of different ways, but it's that the appellate court must review the evidence in the light most favorable to the trial court's order. It must presume all findings in favor of the trial court's order.
In fact, the Court of Appeals in this case cited Benson and relied on that same rule of trial court discretion.
The appellate court in this case, Your Honor, said all the right things and then did the wrong thing. It cited all the law for the standard of review, and then it proceeded to do a de novo review. If you go through the opinion of the case, the court chronicled its own findings on all of these things. It didn't defer in any respect on any of the six elements of Rule 42 to the trial court's determination. And it is a discretionary standard of review that the appellate court failed to properly apply here.
Although this court itself said it had to do so.
This court itself said it had to do so, and then it failed to do so. Again, it said the right things. It quoted the right language. It aptly set out. It even said if there's conflicting facts, you must adopt the position that is consistent with the trial court's, and then it went right on and rejected the facts that were conflicting here.
Can you grant a mandamus, even if we have the power to grant a mandamus, on the grounds that the law is mistaken? I mean, Walker and Packer sets out several grounds on which mandamus can be granted, and they're not all available in this case.
Well,
in light of Justice Heck's question.
Walker versus Packer, I believe, would certainly permit you to vacate the appellate court's order on the basis that it has no, it abuses discretion, and it has no discretion to misapply the law. It can say what the law is, but when it misapplies it, that, I believe, is where it abuses its discretion. It also reversed the entire burden. The burden is on the movements under Rule 42. It reversed that burden, and as it went through the opinion, it chronicled all of the factors that it believed supported overturning the lower court's opinion, rather than looking for the factors that are in support of it, as it's bound to do under the standard review for discretionary actions by the trial court. There's no right to bring a class action here. The plaintiffs had to convince the trial court that he should exercise his discretion and certify the class. The rule itself says may. It uses the word may. The burden is on those proponents of the issue to convince the trial court in his discretion that they're entitled to a class certification.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court and counsel, good morning. My name is Tom Wright. As has already been demonstrated in the questioning of my opponent, this case involves serious questions of stare decisis and judicial restraint. Deloitte is here asking this court to do something completely unprecedented. This court has never issued a writ of mandamus to a court of appeals to require it to change its opinion in a case where the court of appeals was exercising appellate jurisdiction. This court has limited its mandamus power to what the legislature has granted, and that is when the writ is agreeable to the principles of law.
Is this the only case, reported case, where an appellate court has reversed a trial court order denying certification and ordering certification?
The only case in the Texas system, there are cases in the federal system and maybe in other state systems where that exact thing has happened. If the appellate...
Do you have cases that you cited? I believe they make a rather broad statement that there is no other case. I don't know if they just limit it to Texas.
I believe they did limit it to Texas, but we'll be happy to provide those citations of the federal cases. The statute gives a right of appeal, so unless the trial court is always correct, there's eventually going to be a case where the trial court is reversed for denying certification. Contrary to what Mr. Lillienstern said, the trial court does not have any sort of absolute discretion on this issue. The only situation that I know of that a trial court has absolute discretion is in granting a new trial, as long as they don't state the wrong reason. If it were true that the trial court had absolute discretion to deny or grant class certification, there would be no need for an interlocutory appeal statute. Furthermore, this court would have its own hands tied. This court said in the Bloyette case that the trial court is supposed to be the guardian for the class, and how is this court supposed to make sure that that happens if the trial court has absolute discretion, certifying classes, approving settlements, and that sort of thing?
Well, as far as some of the statements made in the Court of Appeals opinion, for example, on page 10 of the slip opinion, it said it is improper at the certification stage for the court to determine which law applies. How can that possibly be the case when you have a class action involving people who purchase securities outside of the state of Texas? And how can the court determine adequate representation and the other issues it's required to decide under Rule 42 without determining what the substantive law is?
Your Honor makes a very good point, and I believe that in some cases, if there is a serious question about what law should apply, the trial court should take that up. It will be a preliminary decision, of course, as is the class certification decision.
But the Court of Appeals has ordered the certification of this class without a determination of what law applies to the class.
Your Honor, there's no issue in this case about what law should apply. As much as Mr. Lillienstern tried to make an issue out of it, all of the defendants were from Texas. All the conduct occurred here. This has got to be the first case in which Texas residents stand here and say to you that they are not subject to the Texas Securities Act. The fact that some of the plaintiffs may have lived in other states is just one of the many restatement factors. All of these factors would urge this court, as the Court of Appeals noted in a footnote, to apply Texas law. The second problem is Deloitte tries to flip the burden. The burden in Texas on proving foreign law has always been on the person who wants foreign law to apply. To put that burden on the party who is arguing for Texas law to apply makes no sense at all, even in the class certification context.
Will you address the Richard Ducata argument?
I beg your pardon? Oh, Richard Ducata.
In the law of the case. Problems.
That is absolutely inappropriate for Mr. Lillienstern to suggest that we would argue that. Class certification can be altered at any time, and we would be, the rule says that. We would be fools.
How would that work? The trial court decided that a week from now that if we were to deny the mandamus, a week from now the trial court could say the Court of Appeals has ordered the certification, but based on circumstances intervening during this last week, I now order decertification.
Well,
and then there'd be another appeal to the Court of Appeals. Would it be sort of a ping-pong match between the trial court and Court of Appeals?
If the trial court held an evidentiary hearing and had some determination about that, this court already has before it another case raising the question of which cases fall in that interlocutory appeal statute. Orders that shrink the class or expand it and this and that. But if it were to happen that this court would deny mandamus and the trial court would enter the same order, then I suppose we would be obliged to file another appeal. I don't believe that's going to happen. The trial court will...
If you did file another appeal, you would not argue law of the case.
Well, I suppose that we could say that absent some change in circumstance that somebody can articulate, I guess it would be law of the case, but that's not what the rule anticipates.
So if they can come up with, if they can articulate some change in circumstance, you would not argue law of the case?
We would not argue law of the case if they could articulate and had presented evidence to the trial court of some change in circumstance. We would be arguing about that change in circumstance and what difference that made.
May I ask you about another statement in the Court of Appeals opinion? On page 14 of the slip opinion, the court said the question in terms of adequate representation of the class representative says the question is whether the class representatives through their attorney will vigorously prosecute the class action. Didn't the Court of Appeals skew the rule that we articulated, or at least repeated in Bloyett, that there's an inherent conflict between class counsel and the class, and thus there must be vigorous oversight by the trial court and the class representative to make sure that that conflict doesn't become intolerable?
Well, the conflict that arose in Bloyett was because of the settlement, where the clients got the coupons and the lawyers got the money. That is not the issue here. The issue at the initial certification stage, where there is no settlement pending, is will the class representatives, and of course by using lawyers, I have to use lawyers, prosecute the class case. These class representatives know everything that the law requires them to know about their case. Of course they didn't know about the fraud when it happened. They wouldn't have purchased the stock. But they know about stocks, and they have demonstrated that they have the knowledge and the involvement necessary to see this class case through. The true irony is, of course, defendants in Deloitte's position would prefer that there be no representation at all. And if you read the cases from around the country, even Deloitte and other defendants will take inconsistent positions about class representatives. They know too much. They know too little. They're too sophisticated. They've never done this before. And on any basis, they will make those kind of arguments. The federal courts have seen through that and noted that all that is really required is that they have the same injury and that they be involved, that they have some minimal knowledge of their own claim, because that's all they can be called upon to testify about at the trial.
How can they police the activities of class counsel if they are figureheads?
Well, in this case, they're not figureheads, but they police class counsel just like any other client does. I have many clients, if they are lawyers, sometimes they try to stick their nose into the case a little further than others. But lay people tell me routinely, you know, we're going to take your advice. In this case, we expect the class representatives to work with us at every point. And really, the main point they have to work with us is if there's a settlement. Because if there's a trial, we're the trial lawyers. We know how to try a case. So it really comes up in the settlement context, which goes back to the Bloyett statement that not only us and the class representatives, but the trial court, need to be involved to make sure that the interests are protected.
What significance, if any, should we place on the fact that these plaintiffs, purported representative members of the class, were solicited by counsel, and that they cannot possibly be good representatives of the class because they're not class members? They didn't buy any stock.
Well, let me address those two points. First of all, solicitation is sort of a dirty word, but there has never been any claim that we did anything unethical in soliciting these clients and writing to them and telling them about their troubles. We got this information from another client who had come to us, who had a case against Deloitte on the same stock issue, except he bought in the open market. That's how we got this information. If they had that kind of claim, and they will never, because nothing untoward was done, they should make it in the grievance committee. The fact that these class members bought debentures, as the Court of Appeals said, doesn't distinguish them from the stock class in these circumstances. Debenture holders have some superior rights to stockholders in a liquidation context, but that's not where we are. These debentures were convertible into stock, and they have the same interest. The very same financial statements were put in two nearly identical prospectuses for stock and debentures, and there's no significant difference and certainly no conflict of interest.
199 class members have been identified?
Yes, Your Honor, and there may be more.
Is it true that no other suit has been filed?
I don't believe any other suit's been filed against Deloitte on the initial stock purchase. There have been other class actions dealing with, or maybe some resolution in bankruptcy, dealing with the ultimate demise of EMI. I think there was a class action in New York about some people who had bought on the market after this initial public offering between certain dates. So there have been other people who have, in general, complained about this issue.
But no member of this putative class has filed suit to that somewhere else.
That's right.
Is it true, as Professor Dorsanio suggests, that all those claims are barred by limitations?
I believe they are.
So the effect of this class action is to cause them to survive.
Well, the tolling rules mean that they still survive till today until somebody says that they can't have a class action.
Why is this a superior form of action? None of the class members have expressed any interest in bringing it personally today, and some of their claims at least would be sizable.
Well, I don't see the connection between, you know, other people expressing a personal interest in bringing a claim. I think when the courts look at the superiority of the mechanism, they are assuming that people with claims of some size will file. It's a general statement. It's not a particularized thing. If it were particularized, this court could look at it and say, well, it's not superior because if we cut off class action, their claims will be barred by limitations, and therefore the trial court only had to try two suits. That's not the idea behind it.
The Court of Appeals seemed to think it was important. They say this is an element of efficiency because if we don't certify this class, then there'll be at least 200 other lawsuits filed. And truth to tell, that's not right.
Well, truth to tell, unless there is some state that has a longer statute of limitations than the Texas Securities Act, which I don't know, that probably will not happen.
Is there, on another subject, is there nothing the Court of Appeals could do in an appeal like this that could be correctable on mandamus?
Yes, there are things that the Court of Appeals could do.
Such as
fail to file a dissent, which would interfere with this court's appellate jurisdiction. But in terms of issuing a ruling on the merits, this court has plenty of jurisdiction over the serious problems that might arise in this context because you have conflict and dissent jurisdiction.
Suppose they assigned this case to one judge to write instead of a panel of three. Could we correct that on mandamus?
Yes.
Suppose they decided that they didn't like Rule 42 and they just weren't going to follow it. Could we correct that on mandamus?
I believe you would have appellate jurisdiction of that because there would be a conflict with the many
between
other cases.
Between this and the
rule. I beg your pardon?
Between the decision and the rule.
Well, or the decisions of other cases.
Well, if there had not been another case,
well,
there has to be a first case someday.
Well, there are plenty of cases saying Rule 42 has to apply, I guess what I'm saying.
Is it true, then, that really the only time a class action will ever get to the Texas Supreme Court is when there's a settlement?
No, Your Honor.
Or if there's a dissent in the Court of Appeals, or in the very limited class of cases where there's a conflict between the decision of the Court of Appeals and some other case.
Well, I guess if by settlement you would also include a final judgment, even if it's not a settlement. If they go through trial and have a final judgment.
Well, like Boyd, for example.
Well, Boyd, was a settlement with a final judgment, but there could be a class action case tried someday and the final judgment entered on the merits. That could also come up.
Well, let me ask you about that. As a practical matter, how many class action cases are tried?
Not many, Your Honor.
And so, as a result of that, ultimately, cases will either settle or somehow they'll go away. But the chances of the Texas Supreme Court ever being able to articulate a body of law, so to speak, insofar as it affects litigated class action cases is relatively small, isn't it?
Well, it is relatively small in the abstract. Of course, this case, the court has already taken that opportunity and employed it.
Well, that was a settlement.
Right, but still, the court said that the same factors have to apply in a settlement class as apply in a class certified for trial. The court said many important things about the class actions. And there are many important issues out there in class actions. Mass tort cases, personal injuries, future injuries, people trying to compromise all sorts of claims they don't even know about. Those issues are not involved in this case. This is a textbook case for class certification.
As far as the amount of the claims of the individual class members, could you give us sort of a rough idea of the size of the amount in controversy? What is the range?
Well, the range on individual claims, I believe, is between about $8,000 and $20,000. The Houston Firemen's Pension Fund, for example, is a bondholder. They bought bonds of $500,000. They later sold them and have $140,000 worth of damages. In fact, our expert reports, which I believe we've provided to the court, show that the actual damages are more in the range of $16 million. The $48 million was the gross amount sold, but some of those people resold them before it hit rock bottom.
Mr. Wright, you,
yes.
In response to some questions about mandamus jurisdiction of this court, if the Court of Appeals, refused to file a dissenting opinion to deprive this court of jurisdiction, you'd say mandamus would be appropriate. Well, assuming in the circumstances that mandamus, in your view, would be appropriate in this circumstance, what would the result be? What would the Supreme Court do?
I'm very glad you asked that question. They would order the Court of Appeals to file the dissent, and that's it. And then once the dissent was filed, somebody would have the right to apply for a writ of error, and this court could rule on the merits. But that's what I'm saying. This court has never issued a mandamus to the Court of Appeals that says you change that decision on the merits of a case where they had appellate jurisdiction.
Is there anything in the interlocutory appeal statute that requires an aggrieved party to file the interlocutory appeal in order to preserve a question of error on the class certification?
There's nothing in the statute, but I would be very cautious in not doing so because of the waiver rules that are applied around the state.
So if you were aggrieved by what the trial court did, that you thought the Supreme Court was the only real vehicle for correction, it would be too dangerous to wait and try the case.
Yes, I believe so. I believe so. And, you know, that fits into what counsel was quoting from the TADC. They have promised this court that when the court exercises mandamus jurisdiction in this case, whether to grant or deny, they don't advise you. They say, please exercise your jurisdiction because we want to come here in every case where summary judgment has been denied on a immunity question and where interlocutory appeal has been cut off at the Court of Appeals. That will really undo the statutory scheme that the legislature had in mind, and it will make Justice Cornyn's prediction come true that this court's going to be asked pretty soon to issue mandamus in the routine case where summary judgment is denied for any reason.
We haven't done that yet.
That's true, Justice Cornyn, but if you look at it, Deloitte is saying to you that this special appeal that the legislature has given them is inadequate, and they were involved in that appeal, okay? And they had motions for rehearing, and they had a chance to get into this court if they could meet the criteria. If this limited appeal, as they want to call it, is inadequate, certainly no appeal is inadequate. And, you know, so every interlocutory order that's entered by the trial judge is now going to be subject to a claim that mandamus is available. And those careful rules that this court has set out in Walker versus Packer and the other recent cases are going to be thrown out the window.
If as I think we agreed earlier, that class actions are rarely, if ever, litigated in state courts of Texas, how will we ever be able to address this court some of these important questions about the application of Rule 42, if in fact the Court of Appeals decision is going to be filed?
Well, this court has many avenues. We've talked about the appellate jurisdiction, and there are going to be clear conflicts. I mean, when the legislature says you can look at this when there's a conflict or dissent, why else would this court want to be involved unless all the courts of appeals were going in one direction and this court wanted to go in another? You also have your rulemaking authority, which can address these problems in a forum that will apply broadly.
What rule would you suggest that we promulgate?
Well, as a matter of fact, as the federal courts have shown, the existing rules are competent to deal with these thorny questions. They have been denying class certifications in asbestos cases and medical implant cases and AIDS cases and tobacco cases. So I'm not sure that anything other than a strict adherence to the rule as it is necessary to deal with those problems.
Well, in the context of further review of courts of appeal, under the circumstances as applied to class action certification, are you suggesting that we have rulemaking power to change that circumstance?
No, Your Honor, that's set out in the statute, and you don't have rulemaking authority to change the appellate structure, but you do have rulemaking authority over Rule 42, and if something needs to be put in there about any of these subjects, I'm sure that that can be done.
Another question. Is it factually correct that you ask everybody that you could identify as a member of this purported class to join as a plaintiff, and only two have done so?
No, I don't believe so. My partner handled that part of it, but I don't believe that we wrote to everybody that we could possibly identify. I think we picked out individuals. And
how many did you write to?
I'm not sure. I really don't.
More than two?
I'm sure we wrote to more than two.
Is it correct, as Judge Peck suggested, there's 194 identified persons that fit in the April 16 to April 30 time frame?
I beg your pardon?
Is it correct that the 194 identified possible plaintiffs is the a number that fits into the time frame of April 16 to April 30, which is the,
right,
the class?
That is the
chronology, isn't it?
Yes. That is the number of plaintiffs that have been identified. There may be others through other brokerage houses that we haven't identified yet.
So are you saying that you didn't write letters or contact 194 people?
I don't believe we did, but I can't swear to that because I wasn't doing it at the time. And
does the record show?
I don't believe the record does show. And I would only say that you know, this idea that somehow we solicited these people and we ought to be punished for that.
I'm not suggesting that, because if you're looking for class people, you have to talk to them, don't you?
Well, we have to give them notice, and the rules provide that we give them specific notice as best we can. And when the class is certified, we're going to have to make a big effort to do that, to give them, if we can identify who they are and their address, personal notice, as well as the generalized notice that's more common. The recent Supreme Court cases from this court that have issued writs of mandamus in special appearance cases and in religious cases, I guess would be a category. Those cases involve a situation where the defendant has a constitutional right to not even stand trial. Mr. Tilton, with his religious beliefs, these defendants that have no contacts with Texas, they've got a federal constitutional right not to have to answer in Texas for their conduct. The Lloyd does not have any kind of constitutional right not to have to stand trial.
Can you distinguish this case, the exercise of mandamus jurisdiction, in Anglin versus Tips, just to pick an example, from this case? There was no statutory right to interlocutory appeal under state procedures of a denial of arbitration under the Federal Arbitration Act, yet this court intervened and granted a writ of mandamus.
Well, that's another case where the defendant has a right guaranteed by federal law that was being interfered with, and the very going to trial rather than going to arbitration would deprive him of that right.
But we had no appellate jurisdiction in that case.
You had no appellate jurisdiction. There was no adequate remedy by appeal because, number one, there was no appeal at all at that point. The appeal had to wait until after the trial was over, which would have denied them the right to arbitration. This case is quite different because there's already been an interlocutory appeal, and Deloitte will have another one if it needs one when the case is over.
Is an interlocutory appeal always an adequate remedy by appeal, even if the Court of Appeals is wrong?
I would say, does
that make any difference?
Since the legislature has confined this court's mandamus jurisdiction to situations in which the writ is agreeable to the principles of law, and since it is the legislature that has designed this statutory interlocutory scheme, which is not unreasonable, it doesn't really cut it off at the Court of Appeals unless the issue has not drawn a dissent or a conflict. I would say in those circumstances, it cannot be said that that's an inadequate appeal. And I don't know of any circumstance under our interlocutory appeal statute where a person could say that that legislatively provided appeal is inadequate.
One further question. Going back to Justice Heck's question about res judicata and law of the case, do I understand your answer to be that you think they have an adequate remedy on a regular appeal when the case is tried and judgment entered because you, as the plaintiff's representative, would not raise res judicata and law of the case?
As long as they could put in some other evidence, and I'm sure they would, that would change the mix.
But you opened your answer to that question by saying that certification is a moving target and can be decertified any time through the process up to the date of trial starting, I presume.
Well, that's right, and presumably that would be done on the basis of something that came to the judge's.
Well, I understand, but does that then lead to your answer, therefore res judicata and law of the case are not applicable under these set of facts because it's a certification situation?
That's right.
That's your position.
That's right.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
The only two areas for future consideration by the trial court as far as reconsidering certification were two, in the court's opinion. One, if the representatives became inadequate or their counsel became inadequate, and two, if everybody opts out, which is rarely known to happen in class action cases when you receive a notice, does everyone opt out? So those are the only two situations in which the appellate court believes the trial court can reconsider the matter. Even if it's not raised by the plaintiffs, we're still at jeopardy that after a trial on the merits, when the case is appealed to the appellate court, the court itself is going to hold that it's not going to reconsider any matters we raise, again applying principles of res judicata law in the case, with those two very narrow exceptions, which are probably never going to happen. This is not a $1.98 kind of claim case. The value of the claims that these purported class members have varies, Mr. Wright said, from $8,000. I know it ranges up to about $3 million. So these are substantial claims. The two class representatives, one has a claim of, I think, $25,000, the other $145,000 or $150,000. So this is not that kind of case where everybody has $1.98 in damages and it doesn't really warrant bringing an action. The class representatives are important not just to representing the class, they're important to the judicial process. They serve as governors on the lawyers. They are important to the judges, they're important to the defendants, because in the normal case, it's not a solicited class action case where the class representatives had never heard of the lawyers prior to the time they got their letters. You have some relationship and there's some control of the judgment of the lawyer, whether it's in the context of settlement, whether it's in the context of whom to sue. So I do believe the Court of Appeals was wrong in suggesting that the control by the class representatives is unimportant so long as they hire good lawyers. The trial court in this case spent about 4 months receiving briefs, holding a hearing. Once the decision was made, the plaintiffs moved for reconsideration. He held another hearing. Then he considered the matter and entered his order. This is not a situation where anything was flippantly done. Candidly, one of the problems in class action practice is that so many motions to certify classes get rubber stamped. Somebody files a motion. Their motion, in fact, is simply a recapitulation of Rule 42 with a lot of conclusions. That is the problem with class certification. That's why the lower courts need some guidance. And indeed, I believe Justice Cornyn is right. If you don't take a case on mandamus, you're never going to get a case where you can deal with how lower courts are supposed to apply the elements of Rule 42. It just won't happen because as the court in Castano versus American Tobacco Company, the Fifth Circuit case that we appended to our letter brief on May 27th, held, these huge class actions put defendants at such jeopardy, at such high risk, they skew the trial process that settlements are almost mandated in every case. The risk is simply too great. In our case, we have asserted a due process deprivation because by permitting these residents of other states to come into our state and sue us applying Texas law, those individuals are going to get causes of action or rights they would not have were they to sue under their own state laws.
Hasn't the U.S. Supreme Court already considered that?
The U.S. Supreme Court has considered...
9-8-1 vote said that Texas can be courthouse to the world.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think so. We cited quite a number of cases in which, in the class certification context, in which a federal securities claim is filed, pendent state law claims are filed, and those courts uniformly refuse to certify the state law claims, saying that because of the notion of a misrepresentation in a prospectus or something like that, that occurred at the time of purchase, and that occurred in your state of residence. So it is that state's law. A resident of Texas who bought some General Motors stock, for example, would not expect that he is going to have to go to New York and apply New York law or Minnesota law or any place else. One of the elements of the restatement of conflicts is...
And he doesn't have the option of doing that. Is that the converse? You're saying if a resident of Texas buys General Motors stock, you're going to be limited to whatever Texas law.
That's it exactly, Your Honor.
And if the defendant is in Michigan and did its dealings in Michigan and Michigan law is more favorable, the Texas resident's just out of luck.
That's true, Your Honor. I mean, the fact that an audit is done in a state or a corporation is located in a state, that's not really relevant to the issue of where the alleged tort occurs. The misrepresentation and the tort occurs at the time of purchase, and that occurs where you purchase. And it is that state, and the expectations both of would-be plaintiffs and of defendants is that you have a known body of law. Just like the...
Shouldn't the plaintiff be arguing? I mean, if the defendant is arguing that the choice of law is unfair, I mean, at least Mr. Wright's point was that shouldn't you be here standing with a demonstration how other laws should be applying rather than saying that the... Mr. Wright's point is your argument is upside down.
No, Your Honor, it's not upside down in the context of Rule 42 because Rule 42 places the entire burden to show commonality of facts or law on the plaintiffs. You can't apply the general rule that you would apply in a on-the-merits situation where a proponent of a foreign law has the burden of approving that law. We weren't a proponent of anything here. The burden is on them. We don't have to establish some other state's law is applicable. That's their problem because they've got to show commonality of legal issues.
Let me ask you another question on Mr. Wright makes the point that the essence of your client's argument is that if a statute only has the right of one appeal, then as a matter of law, that is an inadequate appeal. It seems to be that's his point for this court to take mandamus in this case. This court has to determine that there's an inadequate remedy by appeal since you have had an appeal to the Court of Appeals. For us to hold that, then we hold as a matter of law any statute that cuts off appeal after the first level is inadequate.
Not exactly, Your Honor. We didn't appeal to the Court of Appeals. We were aggrieved by the Court of Appeals.
When there's only one appeal permitted, obviously some person is going to end up with an adverse decision, and they may not have been the one who...
That's true, Your Honor, and that theory would apply if we were complaining about something the trial court did, but we're not. We're complaining, our agreement occurred at the Court of Appeals level. We were not permitted, our only appeal to use that language in the case was an illusory one. We didn't qualify for the appeal. It's going to be a vain act to send us back and have us try to appeal coming back through the system and through the same court that has already determined all these issues.
Well,
under those circumstances, we have
to... Once you have the opportunity to come to this court under that scenario you just articulated.
On an appeal, Your Honor, after being entered to the trial court? Well, the... we probably wouldn't get here, just as Castano said, that the fact that a heavy burden is placed upon all defendants in a class action context skews the trial process. So few of the cases come back up this way. You've never had one that I'm aware of where you consider the Rule 42 factors either on mandamus, I concede, or by way of appeal. So I think the likelihood of our ever arriving back here again on that issue is very remote, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.